You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. I'm Madeline Grant, Editorial Manager at the IEA. The IEA's International Trade and Competition Unit has released a major new report outlining an alternative plan for Brexit. Today I'm joined by the report's authors, Director of the Trade Unit, Shankar Singham, and Senior Research Analyst, Radomir Talcote. The pair outline their proposals, which include recommendations in a range of different areas, from trade policy, our regulatory environment, to the Irish border question, and areas like defence. They explain what is really at stake, arguing that to our detriment, the UK has lost sight of the global prize that Brexit has to offer. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our podcast, IEA Conversations. What direction should the government now be moving in?
Well, I think what's happened in Salzburg is the EU has responded to what they assume is the UK's sort of opening bid in this negotiation. They've been waiting for quite some time for the opening bid from the UK. I think the UK has been talking to Brussels on a pretty regular basis and trying to assess the negotiability of its proposals and have been thinking that that's a negotiation, but that's not a negotiation. You negotiate when you actually put a proposal down. So it's not surprising that the EU has reacted to this proposal by, you know, some counter proposals of its own, and this process will go forward. But I think there's a much, much more fundamental problem here, which is the way we've been negotiating and our whole approach to Brexit, which has to, I think, quite radically change. I think what we have to do is take a step back and say, look, Brexit is a massive global event. It's not about the UK and the EU only. It's a G7 country, a major G7 economy, taking up its trade policy and regulatory policy for the first time in 40 years. That's a huge global event. That's why there is a significant Brexit prize. The Prime Minister referred to the Brexit prize in her Lancaster House speech. We need to go back to that. We need to try and, you know, ascertain, you know, what is the prize we're going for. The prize we're going for is independent trade and regulatory policy. It's contained entirely within that. If you don't have that, there is no prize. This is only a damage limitation exercise. So we need to focus on that. Keep our eyes on the prize, and then determine how we negotiate best with the EU to deliver it. And what we have to have is a holistic approach to our independent trade and regulatory policy, what we do unilaterally, bilaterally, plurilaterally, multilaterally. We can come back to that. But it has to be one thing. It's our one policy, and the EU fits into it. And we have to be much, much more strategic about working with other people, other countries, countries that are disposed to us because they see us as an ally because of an independent trade and regulatory policy, but won't see us as an ally if all we are is a mini EU, you know, basically promulgating the same things that the EU does.
Well, I think that's very interesting what you say about the joined up strategy. It's something that has been vastly overlooked. Our whole news cycle, public interest focused almost exclusively on our negotiations with the EU to the detriment of everything else. But of course, they are linked in a strategic sense, because if you are at the same time that you're negotiating with the EU also making positive manoeuvres towards the FTAs with other countries around the world, and there's reforming domestic regulations as best you can, that improves your negotiating position tremendously.
Yeah, it's rather like a chessboard. What the UK is doing is playing a sort of multi-dimensional game of chess. And we have one board, which is the EU board, but we have lots of other boards at the same time. Now, the problem is that we've bifurcated this so that we're only talking about the EU. We've separated the rest of the world. So we're doing things on the EU board. We're responding to requests the EU is making without considering properly how it affects the rest of our other chessboards that we're on. So we make a move over here on one board, and meanwhile we've sacrificed our queen over on some other board. So we have to be very careful about this. We have to have a single mind over the whole process. And if we do that, we can actually set up the chessboard better so that when we make a serious offer, then it will be received well, it will land well with the EU.
What does your report propose about negotiating with third parties, whether that's the WTO or other bodies, and securing FTAs with third countries?
What we basically propose is that every country which has a trade policy, and the UK is going to have its own trade policy, has essentially the same approach to trade, which is there are four fundamental pillars: unilateral, what we can do ourselves, lowering tariffs in products where we can, and improving our own domestic regulatory environment across the board, not just for services, but for goods, for agriculture, for everything. And that doesn't mean deregulation, it doesn't mean a race to the bottom, it means better regulation that delivers consumer benefits, that actually helps lift poor people out of poverty. Bilaterally, obviously the EU is a huge part of this, but we also want to do a deal with the US. And the US, actually, I was just there for a week. The US very much wants to do a deal with us. Then we have deals potentially with India. We can do things with China. We can interact with China on their Belt and Road. There's a whole range of things that we can do sort of bilaterally there. Then we have the agreements that we have through the EU, where we need to novate or roll those over, and that is perfectly possible. But again, this is a good example of making sure you don't let the EU determine everything, because in conceding to the EU their desire to negotiate all those agreements on our behalf, we've materially damaged our ability to go to those countries and say, here are the reasons why you should roll these agreements over. And we've slowed that process down. We have to stop doing that. Plurilaterally, we've advocated joining, not just making nice noises, but actually applying to join the CPTPP, basically the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The countries, Japan and Australia and others, they have formally requested, the Japanese in particular, have formally requested that we accede to the CPTPP. They see the strategic value of the UK in the CPTPP. There is that. Accession to NAFTA is still talked about in the US. It's still desired by many people in the US. The Mexican Trade Minister has called for it. The Canadians have called for it. It's not inconsistent. In fact, it's absolutely mutually supportive.
Can you join if
US
you're not
deal.
Actually in the North American
It's
area.
An open accession clause. It's just like the CPTPP. So yeah. There's an open accession clause and the UK can absolutely join. And the Canadians and Mexicans would quite like that to happen because it's a hedge against what's happening with their renegotiation of the NAFTA with the US. And then finally, plurilaterally in the WTO, we are doing two things there. We're transitioning, so we're claiming our full seat. And in the transition, we need to be in control of it. We need to be negotiating bilaterally with other countries. We do not want a situation where it's the EU negotiating our transition on our behalf. That has been the case so far, but we need to be very aggressive. The EU has lots of defensive baggage. There's very little they can offer in the way of liberalisation. They are not regarded well by WTO partners. They are regarded as prescriptive, as difficult to deal with, as having lots of skeletons and things that haven't been fully concluded. We are not regarded that way. We should actually be out there trying to do the transition for ourselves. And then once we have actually transitioned, we need to behave like a liberalising member of the WTO, which we can certainly do in services. And we've proposed a number of negotiating groups that we would sort of instantly, I think, join. And not just join, but be a force in. We've proposed, along the lines of the Cairns Group, a Manchester group of services exporters. So we gather together the major exporters of services who have the same problems with barriers around the world and try to agree plurilaterally in the WTO better.
And it's named Manchester. Is that in reference to Manchester's history as a city of trade? Is that your proposed title?
Yes. So I'm going to ask Rado to talk a little bit about why we've decided to call it that and a little bit of the history, because it's very important that when the UK becomes a full WTO member, it becomes a WTO member that is actually a force for liberalisation, not a mini version of the EU actually preventing liberalisation.
I think not much is known about the WTO generally in this country, but with all this talk of a no-deal Brexit or a world trade deal Brexit, I think it needs to kind of find its way into the public consciousness.
The idea here springs, as Shankar said, from the Cairns Group, which is a group of agricultural exporters founded, led by Australia and named after the city of its founding, of course. We are actually proposing that the UK joins that group as well, although we are not a major agricultural exporter. We are locked into EU supply chains in that sector. But the Manchester Group is a concept that springs from discussions that we've had with our advisory council, whereby the UK, as the world's number two services exporter, would found and in many ways lead this group aimed at services liberalisation and behind the border barrier liberalisation and reduction in services. The idea here really pays tribute to the fact that particular place was at the heart of a former movement for free trade that revolved at the time around, firstly, around trade barriers on the tariff level and in the agricultural sphere, the campaign against the Corn Laws. Whereas now, of course, the big game for the UK, the biggest area of our liberalising focus on that plurilateral level in the WTO needs to be because of the nature of our economy, because of the transition of our economy. That city, among others, represents and needs to be among services. I don't know if Shankar would like to pick up on more that we can do in the WTO, whether that's in different groups or initiatives.
Well, certainly we can give a bit of life to some of the stalled processes, and you'd expect the second biggest exporter of services to do that. So the stalled trade and services agreement, for example, stalled, incidentally, largely because the EU was unable to put new services on the table for discussion because of their approach to data through the GDPR. So certainly try to revive that group. There is a very, very stalled group on rules of origin, actually, which is doing nothing in the WTO at the moment. Obviously, one of the things that's come to light as a result of this whole process, it was never meant to be this way. Global trade liberalisation, it was not supposed to be about local content requirements and all of these things. These things are very damaging to trade. And the network of different rules of origin, more restrictive rules of origin, is actually managed trade. It's not free trade. We can revive that to move the world towards a very simple test for rules of origin, which is basically, have you substantially transformed the product? And if you have, then the product originates in your country. But there are many WTO groups. The other one that was very recently launched, there are two initiatives recently launched. One is the e-commerce plurilateral working group, which we as a digital superpower, as it were, ought to be a very, very strong driving force to limit local content regulations and unduly harsh data restrictions, flow of data restrictions in the world. So we should certainly be part of that. And we should also join the combined efforts of the US, the EU and Japan to discipline market distortions in third countries, which is one of the things that came out of the Argentina ministerial in December of last year.
Clearly your paper talks a lot about having a more proactive strategy on a global level, whether this is the WTO or future FTAs. At the same time, the clock is really ticking, and we've only really got realistically until December time to agree something with the EU. So do we also have time to be ramping up this global strategy? Yeah.
So let me talk a little bit about time, because I think this is a very misunderstood thing. Time is one of the dimensions of a negotiation. Now, we have been unable to use it at all, and the EU has used it in the way that the EU always does, which is to run the clock out on you. And so it's very important, if time has been used against you, that you don't fall into the trap of saying, well, we have got no time left, so therefore we should just do whatever the EU says. I mean, we made a fundamental mistake in terms of accepting their negotiating mandate at the beginning, which is illogical.
Did we also, do you think, trigger Article 50 too soon?
No, I don't think we triggered Article 50 too soon. I think, I mean, I would have much more sympathy with people who say we need more time, or people who say we don't have enough time left, so we should just do whatever the EU tells us. I'd have much more sympathy if we'd actually done anything to start with. And if you're in the middle of something and you need a bit more time, then that's a sort of reasonable thing. But no one will worry unduly about that. The other thing about time that's very important is all trade negotiators will tell you need to make time your friend. So far, we have allowed the EU to make time our enemy, and they've played us against time. Time is really, really important. The other thing that happens is as you get closer to deadlines in a negotiation, time expands. So it's amazing what is accomplished in the final sort of 48 hours of a negotiation.
It's kind of like the night before an essay crisis.
It's quite incredible how much is actually accomplished in negotiations at the very, very final hour. And it's that compression that causes the change. So as long as you avoid the compression, you're never actually going to get to the point where you can make the deals that you need to make to get a result. So, no, I think there's plenty of time to do the things that we have to do. But we have to retake control of the agenda. Absolutely, there isn't time if we continue to play on the EU's battlefield. But if we move off their battlefield and
we
play on
ours... How do we do that?
Very straightforward. What we do is we activate the things that we can do. If we have the US desperately pleading with us to do an agreement, wanting to do an agreement, and being quite upset about the Chequers proposal because it means that they can't do an agreement, what we do is we respond to those overtures. You know, when the President of the United States says, I'd like to do a trade deal with you, we say, we'd like to do a trade deal with you, and here's the text of the trade agreement that we'd like to do. We actually, as a group of think tanks, have put together a UK-US free trade agreement text itself. Text on the table is really important. You put text on the table, you say, this is the deal we'd like to do with the US, you start negotiating it. It's incredibly important you start. Throat-clearing exercises do not translate to actual negotiations. And what we need to do with the CPTPP is actually formally apply to join, start that process. So those are two sort of very core immediate steps. And with the EU, the way to retake the agenda with the EU is to, again, put text on the table. It's to say, here is our negotiating text. I have some sympathy with the EU. It's very difficult to negotiate with speeches and white papers. You have to actually negotiate with text. So let's put text on the table, particularly in the areas that are difficult, like regulatory coherence, which is why we have included with our paper, our plan, a chapter on regulatory coherence, which could be used. Put a customs and trade facilitation chapter on the table with an Irish border protocol that talks about, you know, what special arrangements we'd be making for goods trade between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. Financial services chapter. You know, we can put these on the table and start the negotiating process. Once you start, the momentum shifts. People are starting to be engaged in a common enterprise. The dynamics will change. You'll find other bits of the European Commission will have to be involved in this process who have so far not been involved.
I guess another area that, you know, we have some, well, it's probably the only area that we have total control over is what we can do domestically to become more competitive. Radomir, you've talked quite a bit about the importance of regulatory autonomy. What kind of steps would you be taking domestically?
Right, so to clarify, it is an area that we need control over, but in the current Chequers white paper proposals, a great deal of that control would be lacking because of its suggestion of common rulebook on goods and agri-food in particular. What we're talking about here is not simply important because of legal independence or the Brexit mandate. It's about the context in which Brexit is happening. We are in an EU regulatory environment where the direction of travel is very troubling, where our economy is operating under EU regulations that are increasingly prescriptive and burdensome. And what this does is it prevents the emergence of many of our most important innovative new firms and has been creating over the past decade and more an economy that is increasingly sclerotic and dominated by incumbents. This, by the way, the idea that the UK needs regulatory autonomy, needs to be able to set its own regulations across the piece, is an idea that was recognised by the Prime Minister as late as March in her Mansion House speech, when she said that the UK regulation would fulfil broadly the same goals as EU regulation, but did not need to be identical as such. In the White Paper, this has changed. When we have regulatory autonomy, the ability to set all our regulations, in terms of negotiation with the EU, this has to lead to mutual recognition. And we describe mutual recognition in the paper, and the concept can be split into three areas, whereby each party recognises its regulations, the other's regulations, standards and conformity assessment system. So this really, to get back to this question of the Brexit prize, this is absolutely at the heart of the Brexit prize. And if we do not have the ability to set all our own regulations, then we are going to miss out on the great potential change in economic growth from this new normal of low growth to what we can actually achieve.
And the ability to diverge from EU regulations then is essential to future trade deals. We've heard so much about the trade deal with the US.
Yeah. Well, any trade deal, you've got to ask yourself, what do you want in the trade deal? And we're the second biggest exporter of services, so we're going to want barriers to services to come down, and behind the border barriers, regulatory barriers to our services exports to come down, along with all the other things we will also want. Some of those asks are the most difficult things for a country to do. So they're going to want a lot from us in order to give those things. And if for most of the major economies with whom we would want to do trade deals, i.e. the US and the CPTPP countries, agricultural access is a huge issue for them. So it's not just about the tariff. What they really want is they want the EU's regime on sanitary and phytosanitary standards, sort of health standards and rules to protect human, animal, plant health, which violate WTO rules, don't actually achieve the goal that they achieve, because the outcomes in the EU on agriculture are actually worse than in many other countries. And the EU's own scientists in many areas have said that these products that they've banned are actually completely safe. So it's a highly political process in the EU, and it's basically about protecting EU agriculture. So these countries are very keen to see those changes. And if you've taken them off the table and you've said that we cannot negotiate in those areas, well, these countries will say you're not credible, you're just irrelevant.
There are many critics who would argue that the influx of certain products would represent some kind of race to the bottom on standards?
I mean, there is a vision, I think, in the UK, which I think the rest of the world finds somewhat bizarre, that there is a vision that the EU has the sort of gold standard of regulation. Every other country in the world, if you visit with the WTO ambassadors in Geneva, or if you go to capitals of those countries and you say that, people will laugh at you. It is well known that the EU's regulatory system is ever more anti-competitive, ever more prescriptive, and as I said before, even with respect to outcomes, doesn't actually achieve the goals, the health goals that they want to achieve. There is no race to the bottom. There is simply a race to better regulatory systems, more competition, more consumer welfare, benefits for particularly the poorest people in our societies, who, when you are able to increase competition, deal with these regulatory barriers, lower price and increase output, it's the poorest amongst us who benefit the most, particularly in the areas of food, clothing, shoes, that sort of thing.
There's been quite a lot of doom mongering about these products entering the market, but it kind of implies that after Brexit, people will somehow be forced to buy these products. Mm. I mean, surely all that will happen is there'll be a bigger array of choice. People can choose to have a chlorinated chicken or not.
Yeah, I mean, the consumer will always have a choice. Opening up the market and allowing more competition simply brings the prices of all products down. You won't be able to keep your product price high if there are other things that are on the market that are cheaper. And that will make food more affordable for poor people, which is, you know, this is a very large part of their consumption every week. Food, energy, clothing, this sort of thing. We will be able to lower those prices if you have more competition. Prices are very high for some basic staples in the UK as a result of this, and it's very bad for poor people in our societies.
Just to clarify as well, we are not talking about deregulation. We are talking about better regulation that improves not just economic growth but also improves consumer welfare. I think this is a big misunderstanding about what we're saying and what the outcomes here would be.
Yeah. I mean, I think the goal, we say this in the paper, in order to maximise opportunities for your citizens and improve their lives and lift them out of poverty, it is a good idea to regulate in ways that are the least trade restrictive possible, that are the least anti-competitive possible, consistent with, you know, legitimate, clearly stated regulatory goals. And if that's the yardstick through which we regulate, that is exactly what we have proposed, then what you will find is you can cover your prudential concerns and you can cover your safety concerns while at the same time not having the kind of regulation that is incredibly damaging to ordinary competition. When we talk about, you know, things like chlorinated chicken and all this stuff, disinfected chicken, the incidence of Campylobacter in Europe, the US eats twice as many chickens as the Europeans do per capita. And yet the incidence of Campylobacter and Salmonella in Europe is five times what it is in the US. So in fact, in terms of safety for people, European poultry products are much, much less safe for people than US products. And of course, we chlorinate our lettuce and our fish, and you swim in chlorinated swimming pools and all the rest of it. So drink chlorinated water. So there's a huge amount of misunderstanding. And I think the better approach is to say, well, what are the outcomes here? Have we actually saved lives? Have we through this, you know, treatment? Because that's what it's all about. If the problem in the UK is one to do with animal husbandry and treatment of animals, attack that problem.
I think to reclaim the narrative, next time you hear someone talking about chlorinated chicken, we should say, after Brexit, we must protect British people from Salmonella chicken.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. You know, there is this vision, I think, in Europe, and the Americans are quite clear about this. They say, we don't want people to die of these diseases, and we will treat our food in such a way that they don't die of these diseases. Whereas I think sometimes there is a view in Europe that actually the diseases are sort of natural and the chemicals are unnatural. And therefore we like the diseases, but we don't like the chemicals.
This is pure anti-vaxxer territory, isn't it?
It's anti-science territory. I mean, there is especially in agriculture in the EU, it's one of the areas where the regulatory system is moving in a very accelerated direction towards anti-science, anti-technology, anti-competitive, and highly prescriptive, probably the area where that's happening the most. And it's very bad for European farmers. I mean, the European farmers are going to end up, as I think Owen Paterson, who's former Secretary of State for DEFRA, has said, as a museum of world farming. And they don't want this. I mean, farmers don't want this. They don't want to be told by a bureaucrat that they can't use this and they can't use that and they can't lower their costs and they can't have a better product. They see the rest of the world moving on, and they don't want to be left behind. There is a perception that any technology is sort of somehow bad. And that's what we're seeing much, much more in the EU on this. So we're seeing more and more product bans, which again goes against the spirit of the WTO, which is you shouldn't ban a particular process or a particular product. You can say that the costs reductions brought about by a particular process need to be fair and competitive and so on, but you shouldn't ban a whole product area.
I just wanted to ask, how does your paper address the question of the Northern Irish border, which, you know, for better or worse, rightly or wrongly, has become the major sticking point in our negotiations with the EU?
So I think this is an issue that's become very politicised, and I think it's been used by people who want the UK to be in the customs union, the single market, because that is a way, of course, of not having any change at the Irish border. I think the problem is, again, this is another example of getting locked into the EU's battlefield. The idea originally was that sufficient progress had to be made on the Irish border before we could start moving into the future framework for the trade discussion. We've allowed ourselves, by not negotiating aggressively and by conceding constantly to the EU, that has now become, there has to be this Irish backstop. You know, there has to be a backstop. So if we don't get a deal, the arrangements for the border are made so there's a guarantee in the EU's mind that there will be no hard border at all. Well, first of all, there is a border in the island of Ireland now. There's a border for VAT, there's a border for tax, there's a border for all kinds of things. The people border can be dealt with through the common travel area, which predates the European Union, the UK accession and the Republic of Ireland accession to the European Union. As long as the Republic of Ireland remains outside of the Schengen area, and as long as the UK does not require visas for tourist travel from EEA nationals, then the common travel area can carry on. People can continue going across the border. So there's no issue of somebody doing his daily walk across the border, you know, four or five times a day. There's no issue of that being changed in any way. Goods are the problem. And with respect to goods, you need to understand the nature of the trade across the border. The nature of the trade is that the vast majority of trade is high frequency, low volume trade. And most of the trade from Northern Ireland and from the Republic of Ireland is actually with mainland GB, not across the border. That's a tiny percentage compared to the other trade. And so you have a lot of small businesses. So what you do is you progressively try to lift people out of the customs filling in process, the form filling process, move from forms being filled in when goods are cleared to forms being filled in at the level of the trader itself. So there's about 53 non-SME businesses in Northern Ireland that trade into the Republic. This lends itself to a very advanced trusted trader scheme where you can actually put all of those people into a program where essentially what they're doing is filling in what looks more like a tax return than a customs form. And they have to fill in VAT forms, obviously, anyway. So you do that with the bigger ones. With the smaller ones, you give bigger de minimis exemptions, which is completely WTO consistent. So you allow those people to be taken out of the system that way. And you do more checks away from the border. And you use things like trusted third parties to do inspections in facility. So you do more and more of that, which achieves the goal that we need to be achieving, the real goal. And the real goal is that we should not harden the border in ways that damage the Good Friday Agreement and the peace process.
Does your paper proposes an alternative backstop solution, does it not?
Well, what I'd say about the alternative backstop is, first of all, if there's no agreement at all, it is open to the UK and it is open to the EU to simply not to do some of the things I've talked about and not check at the border, not have border inspection posts. We can do that on the basis of either the national security waiver in the WTO or a waiver for protecting the security arrangements on the border. There's no WTO country that is going to, no WTO member who's going to challenge our efforts to maintain peace and security on the border in the island of Ireland after the history that we have seen. In terms of a backstop proposal, I think we should very easily, very, very quickly say, here's a customs and trade facilitation chapter with an Irish border protocol. If there is no comprehensive trade agreement, such as what we have advocated, an advanced trade agreement with maximum regulatory recognition and a management of differences mechanism, if we can't get that, then at least we can get a basic free trade agreement with zero tariffs in goods. and
then
agriculture.
And presumably build on that as time passes.
But you could say to the European Union, that's the backstop, you know, and if you don't like it, we won't have a deal. And if we don't have a deal, we can maintain a clear border in the island of Ireland, and so can you. So you have to explain to the Republic of Ireland why you are not availing yourselves of the WTO exemptions and other things to do what we are doing. And you'll have to explain to the Irish beef industry why, if the UK has to unilaterally lower its agri-food tariffs to mitigate food price inflation, you'll have to explain to the Irish beef farmer why their industry has been, you know, decimated by that.
Yeah. Radomir, finally, I wanted to talk to you about defence, which I understand is going to be dealt with in more detail in an upcoming paper.
Yeah, briefly, we also deal in this paper with what you might call non-core areas of the question, but areas that still have the centre of national strategy and have clear ramifications for trade. This example is one where we can see that the white paper actually appears to have increased our commitments to EU harmonisation from what we were looking at before the referendum, and it shows where the UK would be at great risk if it entered into a rule-taking position from EU institutions. Essentially, the white paper seems to have strengthened UK commitments to PESCO, the mechanism of permanent structured cooperation that Jean-Claude Juncker has described himself as intended to move towards a common EU army, and the UK has offered to host an operational headquarters as a part of this initiative. We'll be talking more in the next paper about how this demonstrates that the UK has to make sure that our commitments to EU defence do not jeopardise the UK-US defence relationship and defence trade relationship or our national regulatory independence.
Well, thank you both very much for joining me.
Thank you.
For more podcasts, blogs, films and reports, go to our website, iea.org.uk.